This is Law and Disorder. In early October, New York City was the host to the fourth session of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine. It was historic. Today we'll hear from Noura Erekat about what was said at that tribunal, why it's important, and what activists need to know and do. We hear from author, activist, and scholar Ilan Pappé. He testified at the Russell Tribunal on Palestine in New York City, a remarkable talk by the author of The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, there are several trials going on related to Guantanamo, including that of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. What's happening?
Yes, Heidi, there is a series of pre-trial hearings going on in what they call the 9/11-5 or something. I'm not sure what the colloquial name is, but those are the five people accused of a conspiracy that resulted in the planes going into the World Trade Center.
The so-called masterminds, as the media likes to call them.
Right. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed being the one that either himself or the government both claim was the mastermind of 9/11. Those trials are going on at Guantanamo, or the hearings, rather, are going on at Guantanamo. And there's a lot of amazing stuff around those. The first thing is that Guantanamo is still open some 4 years almost after President Obama said it was going to be closed. It was on January 21, 2009, almost 4 years ago, when he signed an executive order saying close it in 1 year. I won't go into why it hasn't closed yet. Of course, it's mostly at Obama's feet and then at our Congress's feet. But just to bring our listeners up to date, the present population of Guantanamo is 166 people. Of that 166, 86 have been approved for transfer out of Guantanamo. Those 86 have been there almost 10 years. They're completely innocent.
And one has died.
Latif would make it 87. I reduced it by one because Latif, who had also been cleared for release, died, and we talked about that on our show a few weeks ago. So that's where Guantanamo is in terms of broadly, 166 people left there. There are also some of those people they plan to eventually bring to trial. Five that we're talking about now are Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four others, the so-called 9/11 conspirators. Now, there's two ways they try people. Or now there's actually one way. They don't try anybody except in federal court in the United States because they haven't done that for a long time, and now Congress has prohibited that.
It's all military commissions.
It's all military commissions, if you're tried at all. Most of those people, like the 86 approved for transfer, they're not going to get tried. Then there's 40-some who are just going to sit there forever in indefinite detention. And then there's a handful that will be tried in Guantanamo at military commissions. So let's talk about that because that's the trial that's going on currently.
Well, let's clarify. The trial is actually set for a year from now. These are pre-trial hearings. So this is a slow process.
Right. This is a pre-trial hearings, and these are mostly on what we lawyers and call motions, which are different matters that happen before the trial. And they go through everything. And first, I want everybody to understand that military commissions were made up by Bush after 9/11 to try people who probably should never be tried in military commissions, but should be tried in civilian courts. There shouldn't be such a thing as a military commission. They went through lots of iterations. The Supreme Court held them unconstitutional, et cetera, et cetera. Finally, after they've given, quote, more protections to people, which is a joke, they're going ahead with these military commissions that are completely illegitimate.
And they're secret. So the public really doesn't have much of a sense of what's going on, right?
Well, they're down in Guantanamo. There's a special courtroom. They're now arguing about how secret things ought to be. And so that's a good end to that. A number of issues have come up. The biggest issue is whether the defendants themselves, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others, can talk about what happened to them. And can they, for example, say, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, can he say, I was waterboarded 183 times? Or is that classified? And so what's going on now in the court is completely fascinating. You have the lawyer for the ACLU, who is not Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's lawyer, but it's the lawyer talking about litigating this issue of what can be said in the court, because it's a First Amendment issue, saying, how can it be that I, as a lawyer, can stand here and say Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded 183 times, because that's been publicly revealed, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is prohibited by this court from talking about it. And what she said was, since when can the government classify the thoughts, experiences, and memories of the people on trial? How can that be? How can she, the lawyer, say he's been waterboarded 183 times, but Khalid Sheikh Mohammed can't describe his torture, nor can any of the others?
Also, doesn't that go, in theory, against the principle behind the hearsay rule, which means that it's better to have the individual who experienced something testify about it than have someone else?
I mean, of course, that's right. I mean, it makes absolute sense. But of course, they're going to argue, the government's going to argue, what happened to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed from 2002 or so, when he's picked up, till 2006, which is when he was in secret sites and eventually brought to Guantanamo, that's not relevant somehow, which is ridiculous. The guy's waterboarded 183 times. Everybody on that, of those five, has been seriously tortured, but they can't talk about it. So that's being litigated as we speak. It seems completely outrageous that a person can't tell how he was tortured. So that's the big issue. The other issue that was resolved is, what can the defendants wear to court? Khalid Sheikh Mohammed says, look, you guys are treating me as if I'm a military combatant, so I want to wear camouflage to court. And finally, the court said, you can wear a camouflage jacket to court. So the other day, he walked in with his white outfit on, plus a camouflage vest over it and a turban. So it's what I said in the beginning, when they said they were going to prosecute people under military, quote, law, because it's something made up, so it's not really law, but not try them in regular civilian criminal courts. I said, you can't, what are you, treating these people as warriors? These people, if they did anything, they're alleged criminals. You can't start treating them as warriors, or thus you're giving them a dignity that they shouldn't necessarily have as alleged warriors. That's the way the U.S. went, so now they're allowing him to wear his camouflage suit.
Another issue is that the prosecution wanted the men to be required to attend all the court sessions, and I think it was a small victory, but nonetheless a victory, that the judge ruled they did not have to be there.
It's a big victory.
Yeah.
That basically the prosecutor has argued that, I want them in court. This is a capital case. Our listeners should know this is a death penalty case. They appear sporadically. The other day, I think one defendant came in, then three came in, and then they can change their mind and come in when they want.
You know, it's interesting. A group of family members of people who died during September 11 were actually picked by a lottery to come to Guantanamo to view the proceedings. And I understand they groaned when one of the attorneys, Jim Harrington, said that some of the men didn't want to be subjected to the going back and forth, the transporting, the bringing up of memories and emotions. The families did not like that.
No, there are five people from the families watching. I mean, I can't imagine it, because I haven't been to this courtroom, but it's this special kind of courtroom, and there's glass separating everybody and protective shields and all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And the press, actually, I don't think, they may observe it, but they don't actually hear it. They have it piped in through an intercom. That's another objection. There's a 40-second delay. So that
Wow.
The people speak, and there's 40 seconds delay. So the attorney, one of the attorneys for the ACLU, was in the room with the press, and they told her, it's time for you to argue on the torture issue, whether they can talk about torture. And she didn't hear them come into the courtroom. So, and they've objected. They said, even at the most serious terrorism trials in the United States, there's no such thing as a 40-second delay for
right.
the press. So it's completely weird. It's a kangaroo trial. Mm-hmm. These people on trial, let's remember, they were picked up in 2002, about 2003, some of them maybe. They were tortured at the black sites for 3 or 4 years. And then they were brought to Guantanamo. And so it's now almost 10 years after they've been picked up, and they're finally going through this charade of a trial. Now, we can move from that to why it really begins to demonstrate that this trial is a charade. During the same week that these trials are continuing, a case called the Hamden case went to the Court of Appeals in Washington. And people probably don't remember Hamden. I do, because, of course, that was a big center issue, what happened to Hamden. Hamden was originally going to be tried by a military commission, similar to the one that is trying Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. he went to court and said this is an illegal commission. And the Supreme Court eventually said in 2006, I believe, that these courts are illegal, they aren't constituted correctly, and therefore you can't be tried. Congress then went back, and I think the same year, 2006, and passed the Military Commission Act, which put all kinds of bells and whistles on the commissions. And they haven't necessarily passed muster yet. It hasn't gone back to the court. But that's the courts that are now trying Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the other four alleged conspirators of 9/11. Hamdan, meanwhile, follows separately. So Hamdan gets the crowds declared illegal. They then bring him back for trial again before the new type military commissions. He eventually is convicted of materially aiding terrorism, which is to say he was bin Laden's driver, supposedly, sometime in 2003 and 2004. That's important to remember the years, 2003, 2004, maybe 2002, whatever year. Sometime before 2006, he was allegedly bin Laden's driver. They passed the Military Commission Act in 2006, and they say in the Military Commission Act, we're going to say that materially aiding terrorism, i.e. being bin Laden's driver, which is an alleged terrorist, and aiding him by being his driver, is now going to be a crime that the Military Commission can try.
Providing a service, in effect.
Right. So, and they're going to say they can try that. Problem, though, Heidi, think about it. The Military Commission Act is passed in 2006.
Right.
When did they say that he was a driver?
Before that. So
before
they're
that.
Applying it retroactively.
Right. So what happens? It goes to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals says, what are you guys doing? You're trying him
right.
for something that was not a crime before 2006. And yes, maybe it was a crime in civilian courts to materially aid terrorism, but military commissions never had jurisdiction to try that act of materially aiding terrorism. So they threw out Hamdan's conviction.
Right.
Gone. Hamdan, of course, this is typical of a court. Hamdan had already served the sentence and is banned. Back in, I think it's in Yemen or Saudi Arabia, back in Saudi Arabia, actually, where he lives, and you can interview him and talk to him, and he's walking around. But his conviction has now been thrown out. And what's interesting for me on that is it just throws into a big problem a lot of the commissions that have gone on. There's only been, let's be honest, there's only been six or seven
commissions. Right.
And most of them have been guilty pleas because people just want to get out of there. So it's been a little used tool until these new Khalid Sheikh Mohammed trials. But my first client and the center's first client was someone named David Hicks, who was an Australian. David eventually got railroaded, but he pled guilty and then got out of there and served 9 months in Australia or 9 months in Guantanamo and then got free in Australia where he's walking around. His guilty plea was to materially aiding terrorism, which he also gave up his right to appeal when he took the guilty plea, but it's no good.
And what was he accused of doing?
Can't have been much.
Right.
He wouldn't have gotten 9 months
right.
in prison if it was major. So now his guilty plea is really invalid, although he has no right to appeal it, because that's the same law that the Hamdan case held invalid. And the final side to that is he wrote a book in Australia that's apparently a very good book on what happened to him at Guantanamo, et cetera. And, of course, the government came along and said, we want the proceeds of the book because you pleaded guilty to a crime. And now the now there's no real crime. So now
right.
he should get the proceeds of the book.
Interesting.
You know, what you have is from the inception is taking 9/11 and instead of treating it as the criminal act it was, trying to meld it into military law where you can then make up the rules, and that both presidents have done that, and then they get completely hamstrung by the fact that these are not real laws. These are either retroactive or they weren't meant to be tried by military commissions or there's no real rights. I mean, it's a charade.
It's very Alice in Wonderland-like.
It's a charade in Guantanamo. And, you know, it's 11 years now. And, you know, if we last another 11 years on this show, we'll be talking to you about it then.
Well, in a year from now, we'll be talking about the actual trial in this case. So
I'm not betting on anything in this case. But okay, but you're right, Heidi. It's a year from now before the actual trial.
Michael, I understand that the center, along with former Spanish Judge Baltasar Garzón, counsel to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, recently sent a letter asking for confirmation of whether Assange is a target or subject of a federal grand jury investigation for alleged violations of the Espionage Act.
Yes, Heidi, and here's what's going on. As our listeners know, Julian Assange is still in the Ecuadorian embassy. And the question is, what's going to happen next? If Sweden is willing to question him in the embassy in London, that would be great. If Sweden is willing to let him go to the Ecuadorian embassy in Sweden and be questioned there, that would be great. That would likely resolve the matter. The other way to resolve the matter, so Julian Assange can voluntarily go to Sweden without the fear of being extradited to the United States, is for the United States to give a guarantee that they will not prosecute or try and extradite Julian Assange from Sweden to the United States. And there's a lot of evidence, of course, that the U.S. is trying to do that. We've gone over that at length on this radio show, from the grand jury to subpoenaing Twitter accounts of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, stopping people who were friends of Julian Assange at the border. But there are still those doubters who say, well, he maybe is just trying to escape the sexual allegations in Sweden, which to me has never been right, that position that he's trying to escape those. He would be glad to go to Sweden if he didn't know he might be forwarded on very quickly to the United States and conditions similar to those that Bradley Manning was put in. So to try and put that to rest, my office, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Judge Garzon, former Judge Garzon, wrote a letter to Eric Holder asking for them to confirm or deny there's an investigation and or possible trial of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange in the United States. And to read from this letter just for a second, specifically, quote, we request that the Department of Justice confirm that Mr. Assange is not a target or subject of any federal grand jury investigation for alleged violations of the Espionage Act of 1917 or other federal criminal law. So we asked them to do that specifically. But we also asked them to do something else that's interesting in terms of the National Defense Authorization Act, because there's been lots of speculation as well as some actual documents indicating that they could treat Julian Assange as an enemy.
Exactly. Now, the theory would be, the legal theory would be that he might have provided substantial report to Al-Qaeda or associated forces by publishing information passed to him by Bradley Manning, right?
You got it exactly right, Heidi. Which is to say, Bradley Manning is sitting there allegedly with a bunch of documents. He gives them to WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks uploads them or publishes them all over the world. Al-Qaeda reads it. And then you prosecute. First, they're prosecuting Manning on the idea that he's aiding the enemy. So why wouldn't they be able to prosecute or go after Julian Assange, that he's not just aiding the enemy, but that's a military law, but that he's giving substantial aid to Al-Qaeda, which brings him within the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, and gives the U.S., according to the U.S., the right to capture or kill him anywhere in the world. And so what our letter says, finally, we request confirmation that the United States does not regard Mr. Assange as subject to the indefinite detention provisions of the National Defense Authorization Act under a theory that Mr. Assange may have provided, quote, substantial support to Al-Qaeda or associated forces by publishing information passed to him. We sent this letter October 11th. By the time our listeners hear this show, it'll be the 20th. So far, we've gotten no answer from the Justice Department.
And, Michael, what are the chances that you're going to hear from the DOJ?
Well, I think I'm going to hit the lottery first.
But this is an important, the letter is important because it brings these issues and theories to the public forum and hopefully increases awareness of this.
Yes, I agree. And it's outrageous to be going around here for the Justice Department and others to go around saying Julian Assange should go to Sweden and answer the allegations of sexual misconduct without saying that they won't prosecute him in the United States. The United States sort of wants it both ways. They don't want to really answer our letter, most likely, and they don't want to say that they aren't doing something against Julian Assange because they'd rather keep him in some kind of jeopardy. In early October, the Russell Tribunal on Palestine had its fourth meeting in New York City. As many listeners may know, the tribunal was created in response to the international community's inaction regarding Israel's recognized violation of international law, both in Israel itself as well as in the occupied territories. The tribunal has an incredible list of jurors and speakers, including Angela Davis, Noam Chomsky, Ilan Pappé, Peter Hansen, Diana Buttu, Phyllis Bennis, Kate Gallagher, and Russell Means. to tell us something about what happened at this last meeting of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine, we are pleased to have Noura Erekat. Noura is a human rights attorney. She's involved with BDS campaigns. Noura, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Now, Noura, I know you were at the last session of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine in New York. Is that the first time you've been to a Russell Tribunal?
It actually is, although the Russell Tribunal has started and been in progress for approximately 4 years, from Barcelona to London in Cape Town. This fourth and final session was my first opportunity to attend and participate.
Can you give us a sense, first of all, how did the Russell Tribunal come about?
Sure. So the Russell Tribunal, this Russell Tribunal emulates an earlier historical practices. It was established by philosopher Bertrand Russell to investigate the U.S.'s involvement in Southeast Asia, and namely in Vietnam and Laos. And the idea is that it's not a court or a judicial process, but that it's an opportunity for the world to judge and to evaluate how states have behaved vis-a-vis humanity. And so several tribunals have been held thereafter that explored violations in Latin America and also for violations in Iraq. That one, Arundhati Roy, proceeded over. This one in particular was more of a collaborative effort, and a suggestion was made to the Bertrand Russell Foundation to investigate this question. And so it comes as a result of a thorough review process and a decision by the foundation itself to support this process from the first session to its last.
So now the session you attended in New York, what was it about? What was the theme of it? And what were some of the highlights in your view?
So each of the sessions focuses on a different component of the problems that has led to the failure to achieve a solution to what some may describe as the Palestinian-Israel conflict, and more specifically, to really achieve Palestinian self-determination and equality with their Jewish-Israeli counterparts. And so the first tribunal explored the European Union's complicity in this. I mean, this is an intransigent crisis. Israel has been established since 1948. Upon its establishment, a condition for its acceptance into the United Nations was its acceptance of returning Palestinian refugees to their homes per UN Resolution 194. Since then, rather than actually pressure Israel to comply with these norms, its violations have increased in intensity and in quantity even, and since the aftermath of the 1967 war has been supported by unequivocal U.S. financial, military, and diplomatic support. So we have a crisis that the UN has been able to resolve, that states, however willing they are unable to resolve. What each of the sessions did was explore the details of, for example, you know, the EU's inability to resolve this conflict. That amounts to complicity in the conflict. The corporations that are involved in funding the Israeli military arsenal, as well as its, you know, the expansion, even its construction arsenal to expand its colonial settlements in the occupied territory, as well as building a wall deemed illegal by the International Court of Justice. This is corporate complicity. In South Africa, the session focused on the applicability of the term apartheid and whether or not apartheid, which isn't just about South Africa, but is a crime against humanity as legislated in international law, applies to the situation in Palestine and Israel, and the tribunal found that it did. And this fourth and final session brought everything back to the U.S. and to the New York, and to New York specifically, because the U.S. has proven to be the primary obstacle to resolving this conflict and to delivering equality and self-determination to Palestinians and Israelis.
What were some of the highlights of U.S. obstructionism that came out at this weekend?
One of the greatest highlights was delivered by Catherine Gallagher, a CCR attorney, Center for Constitutional Rights attorney, who described in great detail the amount of military aid that the U.S. provides to Israel, but also, in addition to the amount, the particular way in which it's delivered, which sets it apart from all of its former foreign counterparts. So consider first that Israel has received $115 billion in aid since World War II, which makes it the highest recipient of U.S. foreign aid. In addition to that, it receives approximately $3 billion in aid a year, which makes its benefit from the U.S. higher than all of Latin America and Sub-Saharan Africa combined. In addition to that, it receives that aid without any kind of review and U.S. domestic law, and specifically the Arms Export Control Act, which conditions that all U.S. aid to foreign countries must be used to further human rights or in self-defense. And here, of course, there's a question of whether or not Israel's actions are self-defense. We can argue about this, but at the end of the day, they're absolutely not defensive actions. Bulldozing homes and displacing people, uprooting olive trees and almond trees, and settling illegal colonial settlers, refusing to allow refugees to return to their homes, is not a defensive measure by any means. And yet the U.S. has not held them to account. Another great presentation was Diana Butu, former advisor to the negotiations team, and she provided a much more meta-analysis about how this wasn't about U.S. compliance or complicity. This is about the U.S.'s deliberate work to make what is illegal, legal, and doing it through consistent violation and through consistent practice to make those things that have been deemed illegal suddenly become illegal in this context as conducted by Israel.
When I look at it, I just can't quite get over that particularly that last issue of making, quote, legal what is clearly illegal. And that, of course, we always think about the occupation in terms of that. And the U.S. failure, I think, to declare that it's illegal at the U.N., but to actually veto a measure that said that.
Absolutely. So, and here you're referring to one of the highlights that was also brought, U.S. intransigence within the U.N. Security Council as a veto-holding member. Its sole veto can stonewall any resolution that would come from the international community where the UN Security Council can exercise its right to ensure peace and stability and security using non-forceful measures, and as we've seen, they even use forceful measures. And yet in this case, you can barely issue a resolution because of the U.S.'s shielding Israel from accountability in the Security Council. The resolution you speak of in February 2011, that had the support of 120 member states of the UN General Assembly. All of the members of the Security Council, permanent and non-permanent, except for the U.S. And ironically, the language mirrored the U.S.'s policy on settlement expansion. Susan Rice, the ambassador to the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., didn't say anything about the content of the resolution. To the contrary, she chided the UN for even trying to bring this because she proclaimed that it's not to be solved by the international community, but that resolution to the Palestinian-Israel conflict should be bilateral negotiations between Israel and occupying power and Palestine, a people, and hardly a state, and brokered by the U.S., which has proven itself to be a very dishonest broker. And so this is the stalemate in which we find ourselves. The purpose of the Russell Tribunal was to be able to really leverage the ability of civilians and the civic community to overcome what states are doing in their name and on their behalf. And that's why it's particularly relevant, because they're trying to mobilize civil society. And in the ways forward, for example, to just talk about a little bit.
I'd love you to talk about the way forward, what you think is next and what people ought to do. And I know you're an activist yourself and some of those thoughts.
Absolutely. I'm so proud to call myself an activist. And the ways forward panel focused on precisely what we do in this moment when, you know, the process is stonewalled internationally. The U.S. has proven itself not only unwilling, but also unable, even when it wants to do something. It can't even enforce a freeze of security, of settlement expansion. So it's not only unwilling, as we saw at the Security Council, it's unable, even by its own administration, because of its domestic politics. And many of the suggestions made are things that we would love to do. For example, removing the veto power from the five permanent members of the Security Council. That would do wonders to democratizing the United Nations. But others that I think we're already involved in is the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns. Those campaigns that aim to isolate Israel and to highlight it's violations of international law, it's systematic and gross abuses of human rights, until and when it complies with three basic international law norms, namely the end of its occupation, its right of return of all Palestinian refugees, as well as equality for all of its citizens, regardless of their religion, Jewish, Muslim, or Christian. And so the ways forward included discussing how do we enhance these movements within the U.S. and even globally. Other ways forward, how do we involve trade unions? And trade unions, we've seen, have been very effective. For example, in 2011, dock workers in Oakland refused to undock Israeli products from a boat as part of their participation in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And so everybody has a role to play. Teachers who have pension funds in TIAA-CREF, for example, have a role to play by expressing that they want their pensions not to be invested in corporate abusers like Caterpillar Bulldozer, which does participate in the building of settlements, the wall, and was the D9 Bulldozer specifically was used to crush the body of peace activist Rachel Corrie, who was blocking a home from demolition in peaceful protest, using her body to block a home from being demolished in Gaza, and was trampled by this Caterpillar Bulldozer. Everybody has a role to play. There is room for everyone, regardless of whether or not you're an elected official or you have a law degree. There is a role for everyone to play by participating in the BDS campaign and also by being part of the transmission of this knowledge and this education, which we can now do through social media networks, which we probably weren't able to do only a few years ago because of the stonewalling of mainstream media to even allow this information into the public.
Nora, that's incredibly interesting and important, because I think the activism is what really needs to be carried on now. I think, you know, you've been one of the people on BDS, as well as others. As we close, can you give our listeners where they can go, what websites, both for the Russell Tribunal information as well as for participating in BDS and other campaigns?
Absolutely. So if you're interested in the Russell Tribunal, go to Russell Tribunal on Palestine, all one word, RussellTribunalOnPalestine.com. If you're interested more on BDS, I suggest you go to bdsmovement.net, bdsmovement, one word, .net. And if you're interested in figuring out how you can be involved in your community, in your neighborhood, then I suggest you visit the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation's website, and that is endtheoccupation, one word, .org. endtheoccupation.org. And for analysis of what's happening on a day-to-day, there are many, many sites. I'll plug our own electronic magazine, which is Jadalia, and you can go to jadmagazine.com for that information.
Wonderful. So I encourage people to go to the sites Nora has suggested. And Nora, thank you really for over the years for your amazing work on Palestine.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
We go now to hear the opening speaker at the Russell Tribunal on Palestine. It was the remarkable and amazing Ilan Pappe, an Israeli who lives outside the country, but wrote what I consider to be one of the most important books on Palestine. It's one that really pushed me, Michael Ratner, into becoming much more of an activist on Palestine. It's called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. The book is a must-read for people as it documents village by Palestinian village destroyed, what the Zionists were trying to do since the 1920s in Palestine, way before 1948 when Israel became a state. So we go now to hear Ilan Pappe in a really amazing, remarkable presentation to the Russell Tribunal on Palestine in New York City. Let's have a listen.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen of the Tribunal. Thank you all for attending this important event. It's very difficult to condense a historical analysis and transform it into an evidence. But I will try to do that by focusing on five bullet points, five points from the past that I think are still very relevant for the present. And understanding them well probably will impact our ability to engage with the future. And I bring them as part of a knowledge that I think has to be integrated into any attempt to judge, understand, and hopefully suggest a solution for the troubled land in which I was born, in which I still try and live. The first point is about the impact of early Zionism on Palestine, which I think has to be taken into account of any analysis of the present. As you probably know, Zionism began as a noble movement that had two impulses that one can understand. The impulse to find security for Jews in Central and Eastern Europe, and a wish to redefine Judaism as nationalism, as so many other religious and cultural groups did in the mid of the 19th century. The problem with that noble movement was when it decided that the only territory where it can implement these two impulses was a land already inhabited by other people, the land of Palestine. The Zionist fallacy or mythology that Palestine was a land without people, waiting for the people without land, has already successfully been challenged by professional historiography. But I think it's still somehow not accepted by everyone with a power to impact the reality in Israel and Palestine. It is very important to understand that Zionism appeared as a late day colonialism in Palestine. Now, it was not only a colonialist movement that appeared later than most other colonialist movements. It is also a colonialist movement that appeared in a region where colonialism was not very successful. The only place that was properly colonized was Algeria. And there, the people of Algeria, as you know, resisted, eventually in a successful way, the French colonization of Algeria. It was not to be expected that the Palestinians would react differently to the idea that someone can come and colonize their country at an age and time where colonialism was already understood to be a power or force that undermines and ruins native societies into which it landed and into which it entered. So I think the first point, and a very important point, is to understand that Palestine was a thriving place, a thriving society when Zionism entered the land. And it is good to play a little bit with alternative history and understand that had Zionism not arrived in Palestine, there was a good chance that the Palestinian society, like any other Arab society, would have developed on a similar way, from a nation state to a force for liberation in a place that has a history and identity which was mostly Arab, Islamic, and Middle Eastern. And all these features that are still characterize other Arab countries have been lost in the case of Palestine. The second point I would like to make is about the basic attitudes of early Zionists towards the native indigenous population of Palestine. What is important to understand is that these basic attitudes and perceptions of the natives have not changed, and they still inform most of the Israeli Jews' attitudes towards the Palestinians, wherever they are, whether we are talking about politicians, generals, academics, or common people. These perceptions that were formulated at the very beginning of Zionism are still a very important part of the attitude today that is behind Israeli policies in the occupied territories towards the Palestinian minority and towards the question of the refugees. Now, these first impressions were that the Palestinians were foreign aliens present in a country that waited to be redeemed by the Jewish people. The early settlers, who were obsessive diarists, and nothing escaped their diary, not one mosquito bite, and have not ceased to write about the people who hosted them when they first came to Palestine, the people who gave them shelter, the people who taught them for the first time how to cultivate land. They did not forget to mention that these very people were usurpers, were aliens who overtook or took over something that belonged to the Jewish people 2,000 years ago. The idea of an alien native is very peculiar to the Zionist movement and is at the heart of the Zionist and Israeli policies towards the Palestinians. The third point I would like to make is that Zionism in the mandatory period between 1918 and 1948 had failed in two respects, although it had many, many impressive successes. It failed demographically and it failed geographically. Demographically, it failed because the basic impulse of Zionism was to create a democratic society, but at the same time, a Jewish society. Hence, in order for the democracy to be valid, what you needed was a solid or even exclusive Jewish majority. In order to get a Jewish majority, you needed to bring as many Jews as you could to Palestine and to find ways of getting rid of the Palestinians on the other hand. When the British have left Palestine in 1948, only one third of the population were Jews in Palestine. That was one failure from a Zionist perspective. The second failure was geographical. The Zionist movement tried to buy and purchase land to create a Jewish state. By the end of the British mandate, it succeeded in buying only 7% of the land of Palestine. The inevitable result of these two failures was the decision in February 1947 by the Zionist movement to ethnically cleanse Palestine. And as we are within a framework of a tribunal which has a legal orientation, let me remind the ladies and gentlemen of the tribunal that ethnic cleansing is a crime against humanity. It's a crime against humanity that only genocide is above it. It is a precise act by one movement of ethnic origin against another. And if you go to the State Department website, to its legal side, you will see a very clear definition of what are the origins of ethnic cleansing, what are the characteristics of ethnic cleansing, and what are the inevitable results of ethnic cleansing. And you will see that the case study of Zionism and Palestine in 1948 fit like a hand to a glove in this respect. I would remind us all in this respect that the Israeli narrative today about that particular period is that whatever happened to the Palestinians, and that includes even Israelis who feel some compassion towards the catastrophe that befell the Palestinian people, The main claim, which unfortunately some Palestinians even accept, is that the Palestinian leadership is responsible for the catastrophe. Had the Palestinians accepted the United Nations petition resolution, then the ethnic cleansing would have been prevented. This very immoral judgment has to be challenged at least on two bases. One is that before the Arab world decided to use force in order to reject the petition planned by the United Nations, namely before the 15th of May 1948, and before it was clear what are the positions of the sides, because the United Nations deliberation on Palestine continued, before these deliberations ended, already half of the Palestinians became refugees. Namely, the Zionist plan to dispossess the Palestinians had nothing to do with the Palestinian position on the partition plan. The idea to dispossess Palestine, to de-Arabize Palestine, was there from the 1930s and was implemented long before it was clear what would be the Palestinian position on partition or what would be the United Nations ideas of peace. Secondly, even the argument that saying that if the Palestinian leadership rejected partition, which is understandable, because the Algerians would have rejected the partition of Algeria between themselves and the French settlers. Even if the argument is that the rejecting the partition was wrong, it cannot be punished by the destruction of half of Palestine's villages, by the destruction of half of Palestine's cities, and by the expulsion of half of Palestine's population. Nothing justifies such an inhuman barbarity. Definitely not a political decision to ask that wanted the international community to reconsider the idea of a solution, because most of the Palestinians and most of the people who lived in the Arab world did not like the idea of partition. So I think it's important not to fall into the trap when these historical facts are being brought about as if they justify anything that Israel did, and I repeat my assertion that what they did was an ethnic cleansing operation, which is a crime against humanity. The fourth point I would like to make is that we should not forget in such a tribunal what the Palestinian community inside Israel has undergone, especially in the period 1948 to 1966, when it was subjected to a policy of mandatory emergency regulations that restricted every human and civil right that that Palestinian minority had. It's important to understand that historical period between 1948 to 1966, because the very same military regime that was imposed on one-fifth of the Israeli citizens was transplanted into the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in 1967. When you see the history in one go, or as a complete picture, you understand that since the fragmentation of the Palestinian people to different geopolitical groups inside Israel, in the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, in the refugee camps, and in the exilic communities, you understand that Israel does not always deal directly with each of that group. And not always the same group constitutes, in the eyes of the Israelis, a danger to the existence of Israel. So the power of Israel is transferred from one Palestinian group to the other in 1967. And the Israelis had ready-made mechanism which has violated already then, when it was imposed inside Israel, every international convention, every human right and civil right idea. So the Jewish state, in many ways, is a long history of systematic violation of human rights and civil rights, not just its policy towards the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and I hope we are not going to forget this in this important tribunal. And finally, I would like to explain again the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, because there is a tendency, a very natural tendency, to look at the history of the occupation as if it is not part of a longer history of colonization and dispossession. As if really everything until 1967 was fine, enlightened, and does not deserve our attention. In fact, I don't think we can understand the Israeli policies in 1967 and after 1967 if we don't take a longer historical view on these events. The Israeli political and military leadership of 1948 regretted the fact that it had not occupied the West Bank in that year and had not ceased to dream about the annexation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip to Israel in order to make the Jewish state, in their eyes, a more viable strategic unit and a more viable moral unit, namely redeeming the very ancient heartland of the Jewish people, which were in the West Bank, not inside Israel. The main establishment of the army, of the political elite, has never given up the idea of creating a greater Israel between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean. What they were looking for was the historical opportunity. And few times before 1967, they already thought the opportunity was there, but it did not materialize. It materialized in 1967. And when it materialized in 1967, what the Israeli political elite decided then and there is something that no subsequent Israeli government has ever deviated from. And I think we were all, some of us, were fallen into the trap in thinking that there was a new Israeli thought about peace, about reconciliation, about justice that emerged after 1967. This is not true. This is absolutely not true. In 1967, the most consensual Israeli government ever, that included every political party in Israel in 1967, took three decisions which are with us, and with this I would end, and I think have to be understood and would cast a question mark about ideas such as occupation, the peace process, and a two-state solution. And the three decisions are the following. Maybe there was a preliminary decision I would like just to mention, which is only Israel is going to decide the fate of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The rest will accept or reject an Israeli ideas of how best to deal with these territories. There is no agency for anyone else, not for an international mediator, not for the Palestinian or the Arab world. Israel will decide what is the best idea to deal with the new Palestinian territories it had occupied in June 67. That was a preliminary decision. The first decision was that the Palestinian population of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip would not be ethnically cleansed as the Palestinians of 80% of Palestine were ethnically cleansed in 1948. In these 20% of Palestine that Israel occupied in 1967, the Palestinians were allowed to stay. It was an Israeli decision. It was not a successful struggle against a policy of expulsion. It was a decision not to expel. Maybe it would have failed, I don't know. But they decided not to expel. And they had a serious discussion about the possibility of ethnically cleansing Palestine once more. That is, the 20% of Palestine that were not expelled, were not occupied in 1948. The second decision was that these territories cannot be in de jure annexed to the State of Israel. That you cannot officially annex these areas. Because if you annex them officially, you are, unlike in 1948, are going to encounter international rejection. And the same policy, and we forgot about it, Israel annexed in 1950, in sheer violation of international law, the parts of the United Nations partition resolutions that were allocated to the Palestinians in November 1947. In 1950, quietly, through the Israeli Knesset, the parliament, the Israelis annexed these territories that belonged, according to the international community, to the Palestinian people. And they learned the lesson then that if the international community is silent about the ethnic cleansing of 1948, it would be silent about the annexation of the Arab territories into the State of Israel, and they would be silent about the de facto annexation of the West Bank into Israel. Israel was never interested in the Gaza Strip as such. So the main focus was on the West Bank. The last decision that was taken was that if you do not expel the people and you do not annex officially the territories, you have to decide what would be the status of the people there. And there and then in 1967 fell the decision to create something which we have never seen anywhere else in modern history. The idea of citizenless citizens in a mega prison that was built in 1967. That mega prison, as you can see today, has two versions. One version is a maximum security facility when the Palestinians reject the Israeli rule, when they resist by force or by non-violent means the occupation, then they are being punished with a kind of forms of maximum security prisons we have seen in 1987, in 2002, and we are watching today in the siege and ghettoizing of Gaza. So that's one model. The other model is the one that attracted the world's attention and produced a lot of scholarship and a lot of support. That's the idea of the open prison. The open prison is a gift given by the Israelis to the Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip should they behave according to the Israelis' ideas of reconciliation. And when they accept it, they can have autonomous life. And the idea of autonomy develops in the 1980s into the idea of a Bantustan, a mini-state. We always have to remember the idea of two states is a Zionist idea. No Norman Palestinian would ever suggest to divide his or her homeland into two states. That doesn't stand to reason altogether. It's unfortunate that a lot of our good friends, some of them are here, I'm sure, are still supporting this as a paradigm for peace. And I think this is false. This is wrong. And with this, I would end and ask and beseech the tribunal, do not shrink Palestine into 20% of its geography, and do not shrink the Palestinian people into 50% of who they are. If we are going to seek a just and peaceful solution to the raging conflict there, we should include everyone who is affected and who was affected so that we can build together a stable future. Thank you.
That was Ilan Pappé speaking at the Russell Tribunal on Palestine.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org and look for us on Facebook at Law and Disorder.